I think there comes a real transformation in his writings later in his career, when he has essentially come to a kind of resolution for himself that God may not speak vocally, but he is always there in the form of Christ, as what Enda would describe as an eternal companion who will never, ever abandon someone.
Van Gessel is Professor Emeritus of Japanese Literature at Brigham University, where he also served as Dean of the College of Humanities. He's a distinguished scholar of Japanese literature, including of the Japanese Catholic writer Shusaku Endo, six of whose novels and two short story collections Van also translated. Endo writes hauntingly about the silence of God in the face of human suffering, but also about the compassion of Christ in the midst of that suffering. Van served as a consultant to Martin Scorsese for Scorsese's 2016 movie adaptation of Endo's novel, Silence. And in 2018, Van was honored by the Emperor of Japan with the Order of the Rising Sun for his outstanding work in Japanese literature, promoting mutual understanding between the United States and Japan. I'm Matthew Wickman, founding director of the BYU Humanities Center. Van Gessel, my former boss, it's good to see you again.
Good to see you, and I'm glad you're still employed.
So, to your surprise, I imagine, I'm still employed.
my delight.
Okay. Thank you. Van, I often begin by asking our guests what role faith plays in their life and work. And I guess I'll ask the question of you this way. Has your faith always guided your work, or did those two spheres, your religious life and your academic life, simply exist in happy harmony?
You know, that's interesting because before I came to Brigham Young University, I taught at Columbia University, which is my alma mater for my PhD, 2 years at Notre Dame, and then 8 years at UC Berkeley. And I have to say that my faith has been on kind of a bumpy road in terms of how I've been able to express it, especially in the classroom. Notre Dame was no problem, because of course, especially since I was dealing with a Japanese Catholic writer, that was just fine. But Berkeley was another matter altogether. And I found myself having to teach some of Endo's novels, particularly the ones set in the 17th century, as sort of historical artifacts, as opposed to really profound religious meditations. But coming to BYU, that opened all the doors to being able to combine my faith, my scholarship, my conversations with my students. And that's made BYU very refreshing for me.
Fantastic. And that is the richest way, I think, to discuss a lot of writers by incorporating their own faith into the conversation and making it a live matter and not simply an artifactual one. Of Endo, certainly. One more question about you before we get to Endo. You know, you've accomplished a tremendous amount in your career, both in your field and in the universities where you've worked. You know, you were my dean, for example, at BYU. Having said that, do you feel your faith has ever cost you professionally, whether in terms of opportunity or area of scholarly focus or sacrifice of certain projects? Or has it always been an asset to you?
I see it as an asset. The only way in which I felt like it was in any way a detriment was when I came up for promotion reviews. Because so much of my work involved literary translation. And as you know, translation is not highly valued by the academy. It's something that, of course, any machine can do, right? particularly with a language that's so close to English, like, say, Japanese. But, you know, fortunately, because I was also trying to do some scholarly writing and had a book manuscript that was being reviewed at the time of my tenure review at Berkeley, I was able to, you know, navigate that perilous path and not have to sacrifice my sense of, you know, my faith being at the forefront of the work that I was trying to do as a scholar.
Okay, great. Let's talk about Shusaku Endo. You've worked closely with Endo. You're one of the translators of his novels and short stories. You've written extensively about him as a literary scholar. And you even served as a consultant on Martin Scorsese's adaptation of Endo's novel, Silence. What was the process that took you from being an interested reader of Endo's fiction to being a translator of that fiction?
Well, just a little bit of background. In 1970, I was serving as a missionary for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints in Japan. And it's an interesting challenge to bring the message of Christianity to Japan, which does not have a Christian heritage, or in that period when it had some sort of influence from Christianity, it was rather brutally suppressed by the Japanese authorities. And so to try to convey that message to a people who are, as Francis Xavier said when he arrived, the finest people we have yet encountered, it was still a challenge to suggest that this completely foreign religious tradition had some significance and meaning for the Japanese people. So after 2 years of conveying that message as best I could in broken Japanese, I returned home, and probably the first book that I picked up was a novel called Silence by the Japanese Catholic writer Endo Shusaku. I say his name backwards because that's how it's said in Japan. Endo being the last name, of course. I was blown away by the book because what it really felt like to me was a reflection of my own missionary experience. I certainly didn't go through the same sort of travails and tortures
that
Father Rodriguez went through.
Right.
Yes. But at the same time, grappled with some of the same issues of, you know, what does my faith mean when I feel like I am speaking to a brick wall? And I cast no aspersions on the Japanese people and their kindness and their generosity, but at the same time, trying to bring some who were living, continue to live really very comfortable lives and often feel no need for any sort of change in their values and beliefs, I could relate to Father Rodriguez and see that there were issues raised by Endo that never even occurred to a 19, 20-year-old American missionary in Japan.
Absolutely. Now, what you're saying here actually really resonates with me. I was not a missionary in Japan. I did serve in France and Switzerland. So again, you know, a foreign language, different culture, Western, therefore in some ways closer, but still plenty foreign from my own experience as a suburban San Diegan, you know, encountering a lot of silence. When I was a missionary, there was actually a survey that came out in France that determined that 90% of France was Catholic and also 50% atheist, and that doesn't add up to 100. So, you know, it was certainly an interesting place to sort of come of age, and it really motivated my own interests in literature to ask some large questions. Let me ask you a question that maybe it sounds like a trick question. I don't want it to be. I want it to get at kind of one of the nuances of Endo's work. Would you characterize him as a writer of faith, or would you say that he's a writer of God's grace in the face of a faithless humanity? And I ask this because his fiction appeals to God so frequently in the face of painful human weakness.
Yes, yes. I am going to side with your second characterization of his work, because so much of what we see in his writing is that suffering is a universal definition of the human experience. And what Endo brings to his writing is a clear sense that life is full of brutality and man's inhumanity to man. Man clawing for some kind of relief, for some kind of answers that don't seem to be forthcoming, and wondering if there's any kind of solace to be found anywhere. One of his novels that I translated fairly recently has several scenes that are set in Auschwitz. There is a Catholic priest. It's based on a true story of the Catholic priest, Father Maximilian Kolbe, who sacrificed his own life to save the life of another Polish prisoner at Auschwitz. And one of Kolbe's most famous sayings was, if there is no love here, which of course there wasn't, then we must create love. And he demonstrated that with his own life and his own sacrifice. And I see a lot of that in Endo's work, because there is so much of sacrifice that seems to be necessary in order to crawl out of the misery of the human experience, and then find at the top of that painful heap, God.
That's a beautiful image, Van. You know, you write about that beautifully in a forthcoming essay that you kindly sent me. The essay is titled Endo Shusaku and the Compassionate Companionship of Christ. And as you put it there, I'll just quote a line from your essay. You put it that Endo's ultimate proposition is that Christ suffers alongside the weak, and that there is, within that shared pain, a salvific link that pardons all the betrayals and brings reconciliation between man and God. It's a beautiful sentiment, and I love the way you just put that about finding on the top of this heap of suffering relationship there with the divine. And we can talk about some of these novels. You mentioned Silence. Let's start there. That novel is probably best known in the U.S. To American lay people like me, of Endo's work.
And Scorsese's movie helped with that.
Absolutely. Scorsese has a little something to do with that, no question.
Just a little, yes. Okay. In fact, even in Japan, after the movie, the Scorsese's film version of Silence, after it opened in Japan, the paperback edition of Silence sold an additional 2 million copies.
Wow, really?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I went to the wrong. I should have been a novelist. That's all I'm going to say. I should. Yeah. Can you give us a really brief? I'll ask you a couple questions, but first, for those who may not have read the novel yet but are curious about it, can you give us a really brief synopsis of the plot of the novel, or at least the novel's setting in 17th century Japan?
Yes. By the time the novel opens, around 1630 or so, the Japanese government, which is, of course, heading toward isolationism, cutting off all ties with the outside world because of concerns that imperialism is going to overtake them and make them part of the colonial sphere of the European nations. Set in that period, the Japanese government has put a strict ban on Christianity. Japanese Christians are being rounded up and tortured into denying their faith. The Catholic missionaries have been expelled from the country. But there is there are actually two young missionaries who find out, foreign missionaries, who find out that their mentor, who has been laboring in Japan, has apostatized under torture from the Japanese officials. They cannot believe this. Their mentor would never, his faith was too strong to do something like that. So they sneak into Japan. They're captured almost immediately, even though they've been trying to minister to the underground flock of Japanese believers. And there is this horrible psychological torture along with the physical torture of the Japanese Christians, which the authorities apply to these priests, particularly one named Father Rodriguez, who is told that the sufferings, the tortures of the Japanese Christians will be stopped if he will simply place his foot on an image of Christ called a fumie, an image to be trampled on. And that's all he has to do. He doesn't even have to believe that he is apostatizing. He just simply has to show outwardly to all of the Japanese believers that he no longer believes. And the climax of the novel comes when he is brought before this image and his foot is lifted and is about to step on the face of Christ, a face that he has considered the most beautiful thing he has ever pondered in his entire life.
Well, thank you very much. Yeah, it's a remarkable novel in so many ways, and it's a historical novel.
Yes.
Why was Endo so taken with what's called the Christian century, that mid-16th century to the mid-17th century? He writes about it in more than one novel. We'll get to another one of the novels that talks about it here in a minute. What about that period? Was it because it was a period of intense persecution, or was it something else that drew him to that particular period of Japanese history?
I'd have to say that probably the most critical attraction for Endo to that period and to the characters that he chose to write about was how much pain they were subjected to and how much they had to endure. It happened that when he first encountered historical writings about that period, he had been in the hospital for an extended period of time with really life-threatening lung problems. And he had to undergo three major surgeries. The third one, they told him his chances of survival were very, very low, but he decided to go for it anyway. He had one complete lung removed because of the pleurisy and all of the complications. And having had that much physical pain, it was a three-year hospitalization. When he encountered what these Japanese Christians had to suffer, and encountered, actually saw one of the images that they had placed their feet on. And it looked to him as though the face of Christ in the image had been worn down by all of the feet stepping on Christ's face. He began to feel as though here was something that was really an image for his own faith, for what he had gone through, being mocked and ridiculed and even threatened as a Japanese Christian during the years of World War II, and questioning his own faith after the war, and feeling as though those who had been forced to step on the image were not weak, and they deserved some sympathy, and they deserved to know that Christ had not abandoned them, even though they'd had to go through this outward act of stepping on his face.
Okay, wow. I mean, I 3-year hospitalization. And then to come across that image the way he did, that's that explains a lot to me. And one of the most striking aspects of the novel, at least when I read it a couple of times, is the depth of the silence it describes. Not just the absence of sound, it's an existential abyss, right, in which the characters, and in silence especially, you know, Rodriguez, the Portuguese missionary, it's an abyss in which they wrestle with their faith. Just read a couple quick passages from the novel to kind of create that scene, like for people listening to this podcast. At one point, you know, early in the novel, Rodriguez is the narrator. He's writing some letters back to his companions back in Portugal. And he writes this: "Already 20 years have passed since the persecution broke out. The black soil of Japan has been filled with the lament of so many Christians. The red blood of priests has flowed profusely. The walls of the churches have fallen down. And in the face of this terrible and merciless sacrifice offered up to him, God has remained silent." One more example, this one coming from the narrator, not Rodriguez. This is later on in the novel. "Crouching on the ashen earth of the Gethsemane that had imbibed all the heat of the day, alone and separated from his sleeping disciples, a man," this is Christ, "had said, 'My soul is sorrowful even unto death, and his sweat had become like drops of blood.' On that night, had that man too felt the silence of God? The sea stretched out endlessly, sadly, and all this time over the sea, God simply maintained his unrelenting silence. Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani, my God, why hast thou forsaken me?" Okay, close quote. What drew Endo to silence? Why silence and not, say, chaos? You know, and why is the silence in the novel, in your mind, as deep as it is? It's arrestingly deep. Is it autobiographical, or is it, you know, kind of more anthropological for its era?
I think it's both. And I'd have to compare it perhaps to the shrieks of cicadas in Japan, because if anyone has heard that sound from the millions and millions of cicadas that come from their underground, like the underground Christians, come from their underground dwelling to cry out their brief moment of existence on the planet. It is like having grinding of steel right next to your ears, magnified by a million times. And then when that stops, you're left with the deepest silence you could possibly experience. And I think as these Japanese Christians emerging from horrific physical and psychological torture place their foot on Christ's face and then have to continue on with their lives, their faith still glimmering a little bit within their hearts, but wondering why God did not intercede. And that's certainly the European perspective that these priests bring to Japan, is God is going to glorify these martyrs. He is going to send his angels with trumpets from the heavens. A bursting light will welcome them into glory, and they will be rewarded for all they have suffered. And it, of course, never happens. And that becomes the real trial of Father Rodriguez's faith, because he keeps expecting that this is going to happen, and it never, ever happens. And he, too, both vocally and in his heart, is screaming out to God, why aren't you doing something? Why aren't you saying anything? Why can't you relieve this? And when that question is not answered for him, for us as readers, for those Japanese Christians, the silence becomes profound and becomes that much more painful and moving.
Oh, that's great, Van. I was talking with a colleague earlier in the week about this, and she mentioned that, you know, the reaction I had is a lot like her reaction, I think, from based on what she said, that the silence was just kind of overpowering and such so striking. I love your image of the cicadas suddenly going silent. That's really, really vivid. Are there places in Endo's fiction where he presents a different kind of scenario, you know, where a character has the faith that helps him or her remain strong in the face of trial and then find deliverance from suffering? Or was Endo's really repeated theme, his return to the focus on human weakness and God's companionship amid silence?
There are certainly many characters who struggle with this issue of God's silence. But an interesting thing about Endo is he was very disappointed that Japanese critics took the title of the novel, Silence, to mean the silence of God.
Oh.
Because he said that's not what he was trying to write about. And I have to say something about that in just a moment. But first, let me say that I think there comes a real transformation in his writings later in his career when he has essentially come to a kind of resolution for himself that God may not speak vocally, but he is always there in the form of Christ, as what Endo would describe as an eternal companion who will never, ever abandon someone in their sufferings, in their questionings. And even though he may not be there to provide the answers, to whisper those answers into the ear of the sufferer, he is there to provide companionship and consolation so that you are never left alone in your agony. But let me say something about the silence of the novel, and of course that resonates throughout Endo's work, if silence can resonate. the critical scene, and here comes a big spoiler, folks, so I apologize if you haven't read the book, but at least see the movie. Which gets it right. And I'm very hesitant to be critical of other translators because then they can start pointing out all of my problems in translation. But there is a major problem in translation of the critical passage in the novel Silence. Because as Father Rodriguez, who has gone through so much suffering and seen so much pain all around him, when he is about to place his foot on the image of Christ, he hears the voice of Christ. And what that voice says in the published English translation is, trample, exclamation point, trample, exclamation point. That's not what the Japanese says. The Japanese says, go ahead and step on me. That's why I was born into the world. It was to share in your pains that I came to the world. So go ahead and step on me. It's all right. And it's a voice of permission and acceptance of the offering that he has made of pain because he hasn't been able to hear God's voice, but has still tried to cling within himself, not outwardly perhaps, but within himself, to his belief.
I remember that scene in the movie, and I remember coming across it in the novel and saying that was different. I love that, Van. Thank you for clarifying. It's really a beautiful scene, and it's very strikingly different from how you read it in the novel. Maybe we can turn to the novel, The Samurai. Again, as with Silence, can you give us maybe a really brief overview of what this novel is about or where it's set?
This is also an historical novel. Many of the events that take place in the novel actually happened, even though it is a really unexpected story. Because once again, just sort of prior to the real crackdown on Christianity in the early 17th century, there is a very ambitious priest who is called Father Velasco in the novel, who is determined that he is going to be named Bishop of Japan because he demonstrates so beautifully his authority and power and his persuasive nature in converting the Japanese. And so
I'm laughing because it's painful. I love how you're describing it.
When a Japanese warlord decides that he's going to send a group of his followers, samurai, to Mexico to open up trade, which was, you know, unusual for this time, he lets this priest, this foreign priest, accompany the group as translator. And what a translator he is, because he mistranslates pretty much everything so he can turn it to his own advantage. But there is this low-ranking samurai who is the title character, who just sort of ignorantly goes about doing what he's told to do, because that's what you do as a samurai. The term actually means one who serves or attends to a higher authority. And they go to Mexico and they're told, no, we can't give you authority. We'd have to have authority from the King of Spain. So where do they go? They go to Spain. And they actually do this. And the King of Spain says, well, you know, the Pope's really the one that has to give you the answer to your requests here. They have an actual audience with the Pope. This actually happened to this little group of ambassadors, informal ambassadors from Japan. And the Pope basically gives them his blessing and says, on your way, gentlemen, it's been lovely to meet with you. That's not a direct quote from the novel, by the way. In fact, Father Velasco meets with a very influential cardinal who tells him, my son, we can't start sending missionaries into Japan now because we're hearing more and more about persecution of the Japanese Christians, and the church can't protect the one sheep. It must protect itself as an institution so that it continue to minister to the 99. It's a pretty ironic moment in the novel.
Absolutely.
Both Velasco and the samurai return defeated to Japan. Their entire purpose for this 7-year journey has been crushed. And in fact, when Hasekura meets with the Japanese authorities, he has to admit that he, as an expediency, converted to Christianity while he was in Europe. He is then told that he must kill himself because he has broken what is now Japanese law. It may not have been when he left on his journey, but it is now. And so he basically has to question, what was this all about? What did my life mean? And it's at that moment that he realizes that all of these images of the suffering Christ, the crucifixes that he's seen in virtually every room in Mexico and in Europe, is a lot like himself. That emaciated, pathetic weakling that is hanging on the cross has a lot to do with how he feels about his own life and his own mission. And it's at that point that he feels that Christ has been with him throughout his journey, wordless, but still there and still fully understanding his sufferings.
Great. You write that, and this is a novel, I read it, this is your translation, actually, The Samurai. You write that the novel is, in your view, Endo's masterpiece. What makes it so?
Part of it has to do with the beauty of the style that it's written in Japanese, which, of course, does not come through in the translation. My apologies to everyone who might pick the book up. But it also has to do with really the way he has structured the interplay between this very self-centered, self-serving Western priest, and then scenes that are told, he speaks in the first person in the novel, but then there are scenes with this almost nameless throughout the novel, even though he has a name, he's almost always referred to as the samurai. Those are told in the third person. And so we really don't fully understand what he's going through inwardly as he goes through the journey. Once in a while, we get a little glimmer, but it's not until he's back facing the moment of his death and trying to understand what those images of Christ really meant to him that we finally get inside his head a little bit. And then we hear a wonderful scene toward the end of the book where his chief retainer, who has himself quietly converted to Christianity on the journey, as Hasekura is walking down the corridor where he will have to commit suicide at the end of the corridor, his servant whispers to him, "From now on, he, Christ, will be beside you. From now on, he, Christ, will attend you, will serve you as you go into the next life."
It's beautiful. It makes Christ into the samurai in a way, given the definition that you talked about.
Yes, he becomes the servant, yes.
Exactly. There are some beautiful descriptions here of Christ in the novel. I'll just read a couple of them briefly to give our listeners a sense for them. In one of them, Hasekura, the protagonist, this samurai, finds himself frequently gazing at crucifixes when he's in Europe. He's wondering about them. And this passage here, kind of the narrative gives us a sense for his thinking. The samurai, it says, thought of that ugly, emaciated man hanging on the cross, that man they had been forced to look at every day and every night in each and every village they visited on their long journey. He had never believed in that man. He had never had any desire to worship that man. Yet all the unpleasantness he was being subjected to now was on account of that man. That man was trying to alter the samurai's destiny. You know, which is, it shows this compelling, his being drawn to that image. More is happening there than what he's letting on there in those thoughts. And then his servant, Yozo, says this of his own conversion. This is before the final scene that you referred us to. Yozo says, "I think I understand why every house in those countries being Mexico, Spain, and Italy, has a pathetic statue of that man. I suppose that somewhere in the hearts of men, there's a yearning for someone who will be with you throughout your life, someone who will never betray you, never leave you, even if that someone is just a sick, mangy dog. That man became just such a miserable dog for the sake of mankind."
Yeah.
Very striking.
It's so moving. It is.
It is. You know, you turned me to one other novel. I was so grateful you did, that Endo wrote. This is later in his career. It's called Deep River, another one that you translated. Can you, again, for our listeners here, give us a brief sense about the novel, where it's kind of set, what the basic gist of the novel is?
Yeah, it's a very complex novel because you have this array of Japanese characters who are all involved in a pilgrimage to India, of all places. This is very unusual for Endo. He has usually taken us to Europe and of course back to Japan in the journeys of his characters, but in this one it is India. And these pilgrims, if you will, are all going for very diverse reasons. Their motivations for joining this tour, which is supposed to be of Buddhist relics and sites in India. But in fact, one man is going to seek the reincarnation of his deceased wife. Another one is going to say the Buddhist sutras for all of his dead war comrades who served in the horrors of Burma during World War II. And other there is a fascinating female protagonist named Mitsuko, who is going in search of who knows what. She has this vague sense that there is something better out there. She's tried so many different ways to find fulfillment in her life. She calls them imitations of love when she goes through a loveless marriage. But she keeps falling around the really the chief protagonist, a Japanese priest, if we can call him that, Japanese Christian named Otsu. She had seduced him in their college days together, but he had gone on to the seminary, had gone to try to become ordained a priest, had gone to Israel, had traveled in so many places where every time he tries to come to grips with the Western version of Christianity, he is defeated and rejected. A man of sorrows and acquainted with grief, which Endo very overtly uses as some of his chapter titles. And ultimately, he winds up in India, of all places. You know, this man who still professes a belief in Christ, the Christ that Endo had finally come to understand as the eternal companion. But he dresses in the robes of a Hindu priest. He lives a very ascetic life, and he spends his days in meditation and prayer in both the Western and the Asian scriptures. And much of his day is devoted to going and seeking out the dying on the streets of India, putting them on his back and carrying them, as Endo describes it, like Christ carrying his cross to Golgotha, and takes them to the river Ganges, where the bodies of the dying, of the dead, are deposited, and where the Ganges accepts all of them, no matter their background, no matter their faith. And in this work, we have Endo's ultimate vision of religious pluralism, because he's reading the British religious philosopher John Hick. He's also reading Carl Jung with that, you know, that underlying consciousness that that permeates all of humanity. And what he is seeing is that, like Hick expresses it, God has many names and many faces. And even though Endo remains committed to Christ as his manifestation of the divine, he still validates any religious vision that takes people to the river that accepts all.
It's such a fascinating portrait of a religiously pluralistic Christianity, because there is Christianity really is kind of the motivating driver, it seems to me, for the yeah, image yeah. of how it's portrayed. But it's almost a post denominational Christianity. It's really because it is so pluralistic. You know, do those late portraits of Christianity of Endo's, do those resonate with you, or are they getting so broadly pluralistic that they become almost incoherent? I mean, how, for you, do you say to yourself that right there rings true? Do you say to yourself that's a little bit, that's a bridge too far?
Yes, you know, having followed Endo on his spiritual journey as expressed in his writings, and as I came to know him during the 20 years or so that I interacted with him personally by correspondence, translating his work, having followed him on that journey, I was able to understand how he got to where he ended up in this novel, because it is the last truly religious novel that he was able to complete. Again, however we define religious. But at the same time, as I admire his willingness to open up his sense of Christianity to embrace all. And for me, that's Endo's Japanese expression of the universality of Christ's grace. That Christ's grace is not denominationally limited, that he died for all humanity of all times and all places, including India, for heaven's sakes, where the sufferings in India right now, I can't even talk about it. But
yeah, exactly.
And Yeah, Endo, having come to see Christ as perhaps the most powerful manifestation of this eternal companion who suffers with you, I think had to say, we've got to erase the denominational lines. We've got to erase the lines between Christianity and Hinduism. He does that in a powerful way in the novel that I understand, but because I have such a strong personal commitment to my own church and its teachings, while I can understand it, I can't go all that way. I can't dive into the Ganges.
Well said. Well said. We just have time for another couple of questions, Van. I mean, this is you're really terrific at explaining all this, and really appreciate your deep understanding of Endo and of his faith. It's great. You know, our culture today, 2021, is incredibly noisy. It's distracted. I'm back to the image of those cicadas you talked about in Japan, but now that's kind of a white noise, you know, social media platforms. It's angry socially. It's angry politically. And I'm wondering, you know, if Endo, I guess, how do I ask this question? If Endo were writing today, would it still occur to him to think in terms of silence, or would he be writing about chaos and noise? And do you see that what he's writing about, the silence, still has deep resonance today? Or is it a different image, perhaps, that you think most fits our own times?
You know, there is, toward the end of Deep River, an interesting section, because the novel also takes place at the time of the assassination of Indira Gandhi. And all of the, you know, rival sectarianism that led to that assassination, and so much other sectarian violence in India. And Endo took that as really a human universal. That in fact, just as he saw Christ as a universal figure of grace, he also saw the human condition over which Jesus would have constantly wept, as one of chaos and strife and murder and hatred. And there's a passage in Deep River toward the end where he talks about this and says, you know, how do we survive in this brutal world? And I think that applies to us very much today. And until we can get a sense of how do we turn that down? How do we turn it off long enough that we can be with ourselves in our own minds and hearts in order to find out what we actually believe? Because there are far too many voices. For me, one of the key themes of silence, which isn't really talked about, is that the silence, as I said, was not about the silence of God. It's about Rodriguez having to silence his own ego and his own preconceptions of Christ so that he can finally hear Christ's voice before he steps on the image. And I think that that's what Endo is really saying in the midst of all of the noise and chaos and brutality that we see all around us. We have got to make a space where we can be alone with ourselves and see if there is anybody, say, like an eternal companion with us in the room as we try to find out if this life has any meaning given all the pain and torture.
That's a great note on which to conclude. Van, thank you so much for your outstanding work on Endo and really the wonderful way that you understand it and are able to articulate it for the rest of us. It's been a joy to prepare for this podcast and read both his novels and your writing about the novels. And thank you for the time today to talk with me on this podcast.
Thank you, Matt. It's been a great experience for me too.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Faith and Imagination podcast. This podcast is sponsored by the BYU Humanities Center and the College of Humanities at Brigham Young University, and is produced and edited by Brooke Brown and Sam Jacob. The music for this podcast is composed by Ethan Wickman and is performed by Nicholas Phillips on Albany Records. If you're interested in other episodes of this podcast or would like to know more about the BYU Humanities Center, check out our website at humanitiescenter.byu.edu. Thanks again for listening.